This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
On the Record with Gavin Riley.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
3 minutes past 11 this Sunday morning. It's August the 27th and it's Gavin Riley with you for the next 2 hours here on the Record on News Talk. 087 1400 106 as ever. The WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch through those means. The text number still there as well. 53106. At a cost of 30 cents. If you're on X, our hashtag is OnTheRecordNT. And you can also email us as well, OnTheRecord@NewsTalk.com is how you can get in touch. Long-time listeners will know that ordinarily this is the time where I'd give you the digest of what's making the front pages before we sort of dive in. But to be honest, the front pages this morning are almost all universally about the same story, which of course is the aftermath of the awful, awful events of Clonmel on Friday night in which four young people lost their lives. That understandably dominates the front pages of the papers today, and no matter where you look, you see the portraits of Luke McSweeney, who was 24, his younger sister Grace, aged 18, and her friends Zoe Coffey and Nicole Murphy, both of whom also aged 18. The Sunday Independent this morning, principals at two schools affected by the quadruple roll tragedy in Clonmel this weekend have said that Leaving Cert students who died hours after getting their results will be remembered as model students. The front page of the Sunday Times tells us that a sudden downpour is believed to have caused the horror crash that claimed the lives of the four young people after the road surfaces became dangerously slippy. Luke McSweeney, it tells us, was driving the three teenagers to a party. Gardaí were last night examining the scene of the accident and what remained of the vehicle. Investigators suspect that the driver lost control after the weight of the car caused it to slide on an already dangerous road with an incline. There is no evidence to suggest that he did anything wrong or that he was speeding. A security source told the Sunday Times last night there is probably a combination of factors which led to the accident, a combination of poor surface conditions, the weight of the vehicle and a steep incline, all probably responsible. Even light rain can increase the risk of a car crash, especially if conditions had been previously dry, said that source. Gardaí were last night continuing to appeal for anyone with information to come forward. Post-mortem examinations will be held tomorrow at University Hospital Waterford. Local reps have said that it will take years for Clonmel to recover. And the front page of the Mail on Sunday, again, the portraits of the four young people who so desperately, sadly lost their lives. Three young people who were thrilled with their results, says the Mail on Sunday, were just moments from joining their friends on a bus to take them to a party when the car that they were travelling in crashed into a wall in bad weather and overturned, killing them instantly. Details of the tragic final moments of Nicole Murphy, of Zoe Coffey, Grace McSweeney and her brother Luke McSweeney, who was giving his sister and her friends a lift to the bus, all emerged yesterday. They died at the scene, which, as the Mail on Sunday again says, occurred on a steep and narrow road near their home on the outskirts of Clonmel just after 7 o'clock on Friday. I am joined in the studio to go through what is in the papers by Valerie Cox and by Declan Power, but we can't go any further without just spending a moment to reflect on that. And I suppose the comfort that a lot of people might draw from the fact that if it was just a case of the weather conditions, Valerie, becoming so adverse so quickly that there wasn't any sense of driver error, nobody was acting in any way recklessly, this is just a desperate accident.
It was just a desperate accident, I think. And I mean, obviously, there's investigations going on. But it seems to be, from anybody who was there, that the weather was appalling. And it was a bad stretch of road where there have been other accidents before. And the driver probably didn't stand a chance. And then there was a wall in the way at the wrong place. Mm. And they were just unfortunate. I mean, it's one of these things. The awfulness of it is, I think, that all of these people were on the cusp of their young lives. Mm. And that's the third incident we've had like that this summer. We've had the two boys from St. Michael's in Greece. Mm-hmm. They died on their holidays on the island of, I think it was the Eos. Mm-hmm. And then we had the two girls dying on the way to their Debs. And all of these people, they have a connection. in that all their leaving cert results came out on Friday. And I was just reading there in The Independent that the family of Andrew O'Donnell, he was one of the boys who died out in Greece. His family sent best wishes to all his classmates from St. Michael's as they got their results. And, you know, all of these young people, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them now, they're all linked in this, that their results came out. And I think that's what makes it so unbearably sad that they were just at the cusp of their lives getting their results and about to start on the next chapter. I can't imagine it.
No, actually, I hadn't seen that line about the Andrew's family sharing their best wishes. And I actually can't imagine how selfless that is, because when it's a reminder of what your son should have been looking forward to and what lay ahead of him for the rest of his life, you could understand if they just decided to close ranks. But to be so selfless as to send good wishes to everyone else is remarkable. Before we go on, Declan, a word?
Yeah, I think, as Valerie was saying, it's not just the families of those who have died in Clonmel, all the families of those more recent fatalities. The wound is ripped open again, and it's a greater pool of grief. But I suppose what it reminds us, too, is that, you know, with regards to road traffic management and whatever else, where we have these bursts of heavy rain, it's something we're not used to in Ireland. I had only ever experienced rain like that before in abroad in places like Africa. And if you experience aquaplaning, if you've, I'm sure some of the listeners out there may have done, it is quite a frightening thing. It's a little bit like being on ice, only I would say worse, and you have no control of the car for that period.
Yeah.
And if you haven't experienced it, no matter how good a driver you are, you're bereft of any ability to control. And in situations like this, we may find that we may have to rethink how we navigate on those kinds of roads. And I have family from down that neck of the woods, and the roads around there, people would be intimately familiar with them on a day-to-day basis. Mm. But sometimes that familiarity is what can be your undoing when you come across a very different weather system all of a sudden, heavy rain or maybe snow. That could be another source of accidents. So we need to maybe rethink in extreme weather events how we drive and how we communicate that in terms of how we form and train drivers as well.
Yeah, it is simply, there's nothing else to say other than it is an awful tragedy. And after the thoughts of the whole country are with the community in Clonmel, and particularly the families, the three families involved in all of this. Elsewhere, away from the events in Clonmel, there are a few other significant stories which otherwise would have made the front pages of their papers. The Mail on Sunday has an interesting story about how a prison governor has been accused of stealing supplies and equipment from a private side business, or for a private side business. The allegations are contained in a series of protected disclosures by an Irish Prison Service whistleblower. They've been referred to Gardaí for investigation. There's more than 50 individuals of governor rank within the prison service. The whistleblower has also accused the prison superiors of covering up and facilitating this alleged fraud for years. The protected disclosures were made to Simon Harris while he was the interim Justice Minister earlier this year. The whistleblower also accused the Secretary General in the Department of Justice of trying to block a Garda investigation into the theft allegations. That's an extensive spread that's inside the Mail on Sunday. The sidebar of the front page of the Sunday Times tells us that the relationship between Daniel Kinahan and his father has turned sour after rows over Christy Kinahan Sr.'s decision to have more children in his 60s and his backing for conspiracy theories. John Mooney tells us that Daniel is said to have grabbed control of the transnational criminal gang built up by his father. Kinahan Sr.'s volatile personality has also become erratic and more aggressive, sources say, according to John Mooney. In turn, Daniel Kinahan has angered his father by ordering violence against Irish rivals, which has ultimately led Gardaí and the Irish government to lobby the US to impose sanctions on them. Kinahan Sr., according to one source, blames his eldest son for ruining his attempts to rebrand himself as Chris Vincent, a businessman who operates across the Middle East, Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. When he moved from Spain to the UAE in late 2016, Kinahan reinvented himself as a financier who was ready to invest in anything from art and restaurants to aircraft technology. But the plan fell apart when Daniel Kinahan began ordering gunmen to kill his adversaries on the streets of Dublin. Kinahan Sr. is said to have viewed this as with disdain and with some level of embarrassment because of his lack of sophistication, education and social skills, sources say. That's what's on the front page of the Sunday Times. The Sunday Independent tells us that Leo Varadkar has strongly defended the government's new proposed hate speech laws, and he has accused Elon Musk, who has last week threatened legal action to stop the legislation, of showboating. Elon Musk, who, as we all know, is the owner of X, formerly Twitter, he said in a post on X last week that X was going to file legal action to try and stop hate speech laws. He didn't mention Ireland by name, but he was saying it in response. to an article from the Conservative news website Grips, which is talking about the introduction of the anti-hate speech laws here in Ireland. Musk, who describes himself as a free speech absolutist, said that X would be filing legal action to stop this. Can't wait for discovery to start, he said. Leo Varadkar, in his response, speaking to Jodie Corcoran and Niamh Horan in the Sunday Independent, points out that the law isn't even the law yet. It's going through the Oireachtas, so it can't be challenged while it's still only going through the process. He can challenge something in the courts prospectively after it's been introduced, but Leo Varadkar says, I suspect he doesn't know what he means and is just showboating. That's according to the Taoiseach. And finally, for now, the Business Post front page. All looking forward to the budget. Only 44 days away, tax fans. Set your calculators. Tax breaks for small landlords and a backstop for developers who cannot sell new build apartments are set to form part of a budget day package to try and tackle the housing crisis. Darren O'Brien tells the Business Post he's working on a backstop which would involve the state backstop. There's that word again. God, we thought we'd gotten away from backstops, but here we are borrowing baseball terminology yet again. Dara Bryan is working on a backstop, which would involve the state buying any apartments that developers can't sell on the open market and then using them for cost rental housing. This forms part of a number of budget measures proposed to address housing supply as the government recognises that it must use the upcoming budget to make a mark on the housing crisis. This isn't what we'd intended to talk about, but people building apartments and not being able to sell them.
Yeah, I found that very strange.
What?
And why would the government be turning around and wanting the apartments that nobody else will buy? Does it mean that they're overpriced and the government is willing to use public money to buy these overpriced apartments? It's a very strange thing.
Well, if the government is the only buyer, I suspect they might be able to haggle down the price. But I suspect that there's a sign of greater dysfunction earlier in the pipeline if you have a situation where somebody has built a new apartment development. If some private fund, which of course is exempted from the higher stamp duty if they want to try and buy up apartments en masse, if even they're not willing to take them on, and then you have apartments left that have already been granted planning permission that have the funding that no one is prepared to actually buy on the open market at the end, Declan, that just seems like it's like, okay, yes, the government buying accommodation, if it's there, fine, yes. But it's a symptom of massive dysfunction further along the line.
Absolutely. It's again, one hand doesn't seem to know what the other hand is doing. And at a time when the government seems to be wanting to reach out to the smaller landlord, the home-produced landlords, at a time where they're not feeling the love. You know, yeah. It does seem to... It's like a lot of things that have been perennials in this country, and housing and health seem to be two of the long-term perennials. It's not solved simply. It's an endemic thing. It's a systemic problem, and throwing money at it is only scratching the surface.
If there's something that I'm missing, by the way, if any listener has some ideas to how we would have gotten to a situation where apartments have been built and have been financed and are there and now then find themselves unable to be sold and they're supposed to be up for sale, let me know. Just educate me as to what's gone wrong there. What am I missing? 087 1400 106 is the number on WhatsApp if you do want to get in touch, because genuinely I'm a bit flummoxed as to how you'd get that far down the pipeline without there being a buyer somewhere along the line. There is extensive coverage, as has been the case for the last few Sundays, of the perceived crime problems within Dublin. Now, it should be noted, by the way, that the official statistics do suggest that actually assaults or violent crime within Dublin city centre is actually lower than it has been in the past. But nonetheless, there seems to be the broader perception that Dublin is unsafe. And as many people in charge have said, the perception of Dublin being unsafe is itself an issue in its own right. And there is a piece on page 5 of the Business Post about how the Garda's new city policing plan must be more than just a sticking plaster. Declan, when we say that you're a security analyst, usually we sort of view that with the lens of international affairs. But Evidently there's a few issues about whether people feel secure on their own streets, which Gardaí have to grapple with.
Well, absolutely. And over the years, I've given a lot of focus to this. A new retired assistant commissioner, Pat Leahy, who used to be responsible for policing in the north of the inner city and then the whole of Dublin City. And Pat, amongst others, was responsible for bringing in something called the Small Areas Policing Initiative. It was based on studies he did for himself for his PhD. And it was very simple. It was about empowering Gardaí that would be ordinary patrol Gardaí that would step up, that would be selected for this role, to be sort of become the block sheriff. So their job was to know everything that went on within a very small region or area or part of the city and get to know everybody in there and deal with things that would not always be policing matters. So if old Mrs. Murphy down the road was giving out that the city council weren't removing the rubbish from the cul-de-sac at the end of the road, they could get onto Garda Murphy, and he or she would make the calls. But
you sort of wonder whether it's supposed to be the job of the Gardaí to be a kind of a public switchboard for the rest of the public services.
Well, the point of that is that the Garda would have such a strong, solid relationship and know everything that was going on from the ground up, and this would be coupled with additional information that a Garda at that level would not normally get, intelligence-related information on figures in their little sector that might be involved in terrorism or organised crime or anything of that nature, so that if something happened within that area and you needed specialist units to go in to commence an investigation, they would be doing so through the offices of these Gardaí that had the links and the relationships built up. So you were much more likely to have a good flow of information top down, bottom up, and less toes being trampled on and crimes being solved. But more importantly, a proactive approach to things. Now, to come back to a point you made, it's funny, I was scribbling down something just before you were saying it too. The whole thing here is, it doesn't matter whether Assistant Commissioner Willis says the streets are safe. Mm. There is a perception out there, and I would argue a justified perception. The streets might be safe according to statistics, but people do not feel safe in the city centre, or haven't been feeling safe, I would argue, since the easing of the pandemic strictures. And it's the perception out there amongst most people, traders, ordinary people, you know, who socialise and work in Dublin, particularly in the city centre, is that there was a collection of, for want of a better term, feral youth who literally took over sections of the city at certain times in the day or evening, and that they were not being dealt with. Now, what does that mean? It means that there was a lack of police presence. Now, part of that may be perception. Part of that, there's always a degree of truth within any perception.
Well, I suppose that it is a kind of a perception thing, because if they're not necessarily doing anything wrong, okay, they might be a little bit more boisterous than people are comfortable with, and people might feel a little bit intimidated by being in their company. But one would think, if there was any demonstrable evidence of anyone doing anything illegal, you could call the guards and the guards would show up and say, "Here, lads, what are you doing?"
Well, the problem
too
is, it's
more about perception than truth.
Well, the guards, if you listen to what the GRA and the AGSI have been saying, is the guards are diminished in resources in terms of manpower. And in terms of even their own, if anybody was paying attention to some of the media reports this week, where Garda recently retired, recently discharged Garda, I should say, because they didn't have enough length of service to have retired. We're talking about the degree of lack of capacity with regards to their telecommunications, with regards to the pulse system, with regards to the systems of policing, whereby a greater obsession of logging and material and ticking boxes rather than maintaining the relationship with the public by having a policing presence on the street. So this week it was to be welcomed that there was going to be an upgrade of presence. Now, the media focused a bit about the fact of the specialist units, the armed units or whatever else. Yeah. Basically, you were going to have a much greater presence on the street. But it shouldn't be binary, because some of the critics about that say you don't want just a heavy hand. You need a long-term approach. And I fully agree with that. Mm. And indeed, Leahy's approach as well was based on that too, that if you have a regular presence and relationship building, then you're equipped to be able to respond robustly in the face of crime or in the face of people who are acting with impunity. But you also have a long-term relationship that allows communities try and steer people away from acting in a feral way. And it could probably be argued that the lack of resources and the lack of presence and the pandemic did lead to pockets of youth who did appear to be just acting in an intimidating way. And it shouldn't be the case. I mean, restaurateurs, traders shouldn't have to be ringing the guards to say, "Come down," there's, you know, when this is an ongoing thing.
Aside from that piece by Colin Thomas about the city policing plan, on page 5 of the Business Post Valerie, there's also a comment piece by Jim O'Callaghan, Fianna Fáil's Justice Spokesman. "Dublin needs a responsible, accountable, elected leader with real clout." Methinks that the current TD for Dublin Bay South might be eyeing up a new mayoral position should one be created.
This is quite possible, but I think he's absolutely right. And he says, "No politician elected to the Oireachtas or serving in government has direct daily responsibility for the successful Operation and Management of Dublin. And he's absolutely right. You know, it doesn't sit, the mayor of Dublin at the moment, I mean, it's mainly just a courtesy title. Mm. They turn up, they snap ribbons, they pat people on the head. You know, they do all that kind of thing. And that is really, and maybe get involved in a row about the Christmas crib. But we need to go a lot further than that. And there needs to be a serious mayor there who can tackle these things, who has the resources. And while we're talking about the resources, you know, the importance of having the Gardaí visible on the streets is so important. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, if there's wrongdoing, okay, you call the Gardaí.
Yeah.
But it takes them a while to get there.
Yeah.
And if you're being mugged, the perpetrators are going to be gone. Also, I think we have a bigger problem in our attitude to the Gardaí, because you've seen so many times over the last few months, particularly, where there is a major crime committed or something, the Garda is involved, and the investigation immediately is, you know, what did the Garda do in this situation? Did they handle it properly?
Yeah.
What about their driving and so on? I mean, there's been various incidents like that. And if Gardaí don't feel that they are being supported, protected, yes, of course, if they do wrong, that's got to be investigated. But I think if they don't feel that the commissioner is behind them, that they're going to back them in trying to bring back, to eliminate lawlessness from the city, that there's going to be a sense of apathy among the Gardaí themselves. And I think it's very important that we take that away and say, yes, do your job, you're trusted.
That is on page 5 of the Business Post. I need to get to an ad break, but just before I do, actually, there's one piece that isn't in today's papers, but I think was in yesterday's Irish Independent, and definitely it's worth just sending you out on this, because you've actually mentioned this, that there was a report by Robin Schiller, it's still available on independent.ie, about a man named Mahmoud Bazzi, who admitted on Lebanese television that he was responsible for killing two Irish privates who were serving on a UN mission all the way back in 1980, Thomas Barrett and Derek Smallhorn, and that he was ultimately, eventually, justice caught up with him, and he was incarcerated and he was convicted in 2020 of murdering those Irish soldiers 40 years hence. And that he's out already, and that there's something to be learned from this.
Yes, Mahmoud Bazzi murdered Private Derek Smallhorn and Thomas Barrett, and attempted to murder Private John O'Mahony, not in the course of action or battle. It was in the aftermath of the Battle of Atiri, where the Christian militia, of which Bazzi was a part of, had attacked Irish positions that were there to protect civilians in the village of Atiri. And the Irish, the Fijians, and backed up by the Dutch, fought a pitched battle for a week, and it led to, amongst others, the deaths of a Fijian peacekeeper and an Irish peacekeeper named Private Stephen Griffin. And it was after this that these three men were abducted, disarmed. In fact, I'm not sure were they even properly armed in the first place. They were driving an unarmed party of military observers into a Christian militia-controlled area.
Okay.
And they were shot in cold blood. They were separated from the main party, taken away and to be executed. Now, it took, as you say, 40-odd years. It was...
He admitted doing it on TV not long afterwards, but then he fled to the US, and it took quite a while to get him back to face justice.
He was selling ice cream in Detroit, and eventually, I think it was RTE did a documentary on him, but it had been known within veteran circles that he was supposed to be over in the States. Now, he initially claimed he was acting on orders from his commanders, but in the TV interview, he admitted that he singled out these men and organised their, well, perpetrated their murders because of revenge, which is a strong thing in that part of South Lebanon, vendettas and blood debts being honoured. Now, the point here that I would make is the Lebanese state have been extremely indelicate in releasing a man. Now, I know he's 76 and he's apparently not in good health, but he served less than 3 years since he was convicted.
And
he's out already. And it took long enough to bloody well get him in front of a judge and to have him face justice.
Is there a lesson there? Because we're obviously still looking down the barrel of a potential prosecution for the death of Sean Rooney and the grave injury of Shane Carney.
Precisely. And I think it's a lesson for us as a society and for those who run our state and those who consider themselves friends of our state, to keep pressure on the Lebanese to bring those who are charged with the murder of Private Rooney before the courts, before justice, and that it not be just left flitter away. Because the problem with Lebanon at the moment is there's a state within a state, there's a Hezbollah-run state that's really, well, allegedly pulling the strings of the democratically mandated Lebanese government. Now, this I would argue this is a test of their capacity to operate as a proper entity. And the international community should be used, should be brought to bear to put pressure on them. Because what we've seen with Bazzi's release is that there is an argument to be made that do they really take this seriously? For all the fine talk that the Lebanese state has made about the Irish contribution to peace in their country, do they really take the blood sacrifices that we have made seriously?
Very fair point, and certainly something that's worth heeding. A few texts coming in about the crime issue. It seems the authorities want as few pensionable and permanent workers on the front line and as many as possible representatives in the Dáil and Shannon. Priorities need reviewing fast and fast, says that person. One person about the prospect of a properly empowered Dublin mayor says, if we were to get a proper mayor who acted responsibly for the city, that would be fine, but we'd probably end up with an influencer or some other such drama queen, says this texter looking to make a name for themselves. Which is a point that Jim O'Callaghan does recognise in his piece in the Business Post, but also he says that's true of literally every elected position. There's no reason to think that Dublin will be any different or that we still couldn't elect somebody decent who wants to do the job. And finally for now, this is a long text but a good one from Breda. I used to report crimes to the Gardaí, but I never got a positive response, so now I don't bother. In the past month, I've witnessed menacing driving of scrambler bikes amongst families in the local park, open drug dealing in the IFSC, undisguised robbery of a bike, gangs of youth intimidating people, drug addicts injecting into their groin in an open space. If the commissioner added all of the crimes that your listener witnessed and didn't report, his stats would increase exponentially. The people of Dublin know the reality, and they've been let down for decades by the policies of the bosses in the Gardaí, the city councils and the politicians who Breda says don't care about Dublin. Let me know your thoughts. 087 1400 106. More from the paper. News Talk this morning, joined in studio by Valerie Cox and Declan Power to go through what is in today's papers. One text in. Gav, you're well placed to say a word or two about Bray Wyatt. A big Irish wrestling following here, and it's cut a lot of us real deep. I'm glad somebody gave us a chance to mention that for 20 seconds, because a lot of people are surprised when I mention it, whether it's on Twitter or Instagram or even talk to people in person, that I'm a fan of professional wrestling. And there's much more of us out there than I think a lot of people recognise. And people go, professional wrestling, like, are you, like, what's the point? Sure, it's all a stitch up. Sure, it's all fake fights and all pre-scripted. Sure, how could you like that? Professional wrestling is one of the purest forms of storytelling and drama that it is. And if it's done well, it's done really, really well. And I won't go on about it too long because it's not for everyone, and there's very little that can be said about someone else who left us this week. But Wyndham Rotunda, who was better known as Bray Wyatt, was one of the best storytellers. And in an industry where you've seen everything dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of times, for a guy who was actually that young, he was only 36 years old when he died this week of medical complications. For a guy that young to be capable of such creativity, to be so captivating, and to be just such an extraordinary performer in the ring as well. He is a tremendous loss. And anyone who's going to All in Wembley this evening, I am madly jealous. But sure, look, some of us have to stay home and mind the country while the rest of you are going off to see MJF and Adam Cole in Wembley. Anyway, right, 11:34 and lots in the papers still to get through, including, interestingly, Valerie Cox. And this is actually something that I've had a bone about for a while. An interesting spread by John Drennan on pages 16 and 17 of the Irish Mail on Sunday. There is nothing for us to do. That is the moan of one of our 75 grand a year senators, as voting records reveal a third of members have failed to turn up for half of this year's Shannon votes. No one is defending Shannon members not showing up for votes, because that's the job.
Yeah.
But if people are wondering why the Shannon is perceived as doing so little, the claim of one senator, and there's a grain of truth to this, is that there's nothing for them to be doing.
Well, it's true to a certain extent. I mean, they're getting 75,000 a year, and it is very much a part-time job, I think. But John Drennan's done great work here in analysing what's going on. One in three senators didn't turn up for half of the votes in the Shannon this year. Now, there were 57 votes called in the Shannon between January and the end of June. And the level of absenteeism was extraordinary, with 20 of the 60 members not bothering to vote in 50% of the ballots. Mm. Now, that shows an extraordinary degree of disinterest. Yeah. Now, maybe there is nothing for them to do. So that would mean maybe we don't need them. Maybe we could save a lot of money.
I'm not saying this to defend absentees, because obviously if your job is to be a legislator, then show up and vote on stuff. Mm. One thing which is worth noting is that, unlike the Dáil in its present stance, the government parties do have an overwhelming majority in the Senate. So basically, a lot of them can, frankly, half-ass it, and there's never any danger of the government being beaten. So it never sort of feels like anything is on a knife edge. That's not a defence, but it's a bit of context as to why there might not be full attendance.
I think, though, the Senate has thrown up some excellent politicians, and it's thrown up people that we've never actually heard of. But it's seen very much as a stepping stone to something else, either going to Europe as an MEP or becoming a TD. And there's a nice analysis there from John saying, who's looking to escape the Shannon's holding pen next? And he has a whole list of people who are senators at the moment, but who are eyeing up seats in the Dáil in their own constituencies. And I think that's awfully true. Now, it's also a holding pen for people who lose the seats, because all they have to do is get a nomination to the Shannon instead. And I mean, if you even just look at the list of senators, lots of them have previously been TDs and now they're back in the Senate, recuperating, having a little rest before they run for election again.
Therein lies the problem.
That is the problem, isn't it? Because it's a full house of the Oireachtas in its own right. It's a legislature, and it shouldn't be seen as either the training ground or the retirement home. It should be a prize in its own right.
I completely agree. And I agree with much of what Valerie said as well, except the one point. I think we should be retaining the Senate because I like the fact that it is an alternate chamber. It has where people have used it wisely. They've brought issues to bear. I mean, David Norris is a very good case in point. He was very much a voice in the wilderness. But having the place, having his seat in the Senate allowed him to articulate things that got traction in Irish society that probably wouldn't have. There are others similar to that as well. I see my old colleague Tom Cronin. Since he took his seat, he's used a very strong platform about disability and other related issues. And this is what I think the Senate should be for, because when Valerie and I were chatting about this in the reading room earlier, we're both agreeing in a way that there are issues that a TD can't focus on. And this is the problem, I think. If you've people that look at it as a waiting room before they get their seat back for real politics or to go to Europe, or they're hanging on there because they got voted out, they're not really focused on those.
Nothing grinds my gears like a senator who says that they're a senator for County Clare or Dublin Vingo. You're not a senator for a geographical constituency, that's the point. You're supposed to look at national issues.
Yeah, exactly. And so you're not bogged down with the potholes and the other issues. And sometimes I think we end up with people who get seats in the Dáil as TDs that should really be senators. They're single issue people and they're focused on various different things. And there's nothing wrong with being a single issue exponent. But you're probably best, you'd be better placed to do it in the Senate. You can't really, you know, if you have to be dealing with constituency issues and things like that, especially if you're independent. I think if you're an independent, if you have that streak and you don't want to be bogged down by party politics, then the Senate is the place to be, because you're unfettered and you've a much, clearer voice if you use it properly. But the last time this was an issue, do you remember, you know, there was a referendum.
Yeah. And 13 years ago.
Yeah, I was in favour of retaining it, but it was also what swayed my thinking was the fact that there was supposed to be a programme of reform.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened. And what we need to see is there needs to be some adjustment so that the system works better. And there needs to be not just an adjustment, we'll say, constitutionally or legally or whatever else, but also with the idea of who we're nominating to the Senate and why we're nominating them. It shouldn't be just a sinecure for people who've been loyal to particular parties.
Yeah.
And it's bloody hard work for any of those independents who do get elected. I know Tom had to go at it three times in a row, and he really went at it, threw the kitchen sink at it.
There's been some great people in the Senate, they really have, and you mentioned David Norris there and lots of others, but it's like there's three levels in Irish politics. First of all, you've got local government, the county councillors, and that's all about potholes. Then you go to the Senate, and that's all plamos. And then you get to be a TD, you get into the Dáil, and that's all about politics. And I mean, that really seems to be the level they all operate on, except for a few that come through and make a difference. And they do. And I think a shake up of the Senate, but Leo Varadkar has promised this anyway.
Well, there has to be some electoral reform on it soon, because there was the Supreme Court case that was taken by a UL graduate, Tomás Hinahan, who was pointing out that, you know, it's been, what is it, 44 years since we had the referendum about expanding the franchise for the university panels, and wasn't done. And the Supreme Court has ruled, actually, no, there is now an impetus, there is a mandate and instruction to do that, and the government's been given a deadline to do it. yeah. So perhaps by next time we might actually have voting.
Yeah, and also even as they exist, the university panels are a disgrace because the same old are holding on to those seats most of the time. As you say, it's very difficult for a Clonan to get in there. Mm. No, they get re-elected because there's so little interest. There's so such a low level of voting. People don't care. They get the envelopes into their houses. I don't think they even read them half the time. Mm. And if we could bring in the other educational institutions as well, or now universities or technical colleges, whatever, they should all have a say in who goes to the channel.
It always struck me as the daftest thing. Like I'm a graduate of both DCU and Trinity. Mm. And
so you get a vote for one but not the other.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And like, you know, the DCU and UL graduates not have... I'm surprised. I suppose it's indicative of how a lot of people don't really think about the Senate, that it, even university graduates. But I mean, in this day and age where we're saying that only university graduates should have a vote, I mean... That flies in the face of the ethos of a republic. But then so many things we do in this country can fly in the face.
It's constitutionally prescribed. The people adopted it that way. The left tried to get rid of the Senate in the past. People chose otherwise. End of, says Lara in Dublin. Dan says, the Senate is a good idea, but you shouldn't be allowed to sit in the Senate if you've just lost a Dáil seat, at least for a full Dáil cycle. The way around that, Dan, is just to have the elections on the same day. Because people wouldn't run for
And could I suggest something as well? As you were saying about that people had, you know, that's constitutionally constructed a certain way. I think everybody should be able to have a vote, but it should be different to the way we vote in general elections, in that there are panels, everybody, every citizen in the state should find that there is a panel that they can connect into and be able to vote through that. Like, I'm not terribly, I don't have terribly detailed knowledge on it, but like you have an agricultural panel, you have a commercial panel, you have the university panels. And so if we broaden that out a bit more, if we embarked on a program of public education to make people aware, and if we got people that wanted to be in the Senate for particular reasons, and if the political parties got on board with that as well, there are a lot of people within the arts, within business, within John Crown, another example. He went in, did his stint in the Senate.
Did one term. Job done.
Yeah, and he had a few things he wanted to achieve, and I was hugely impressed with him with the way he went about it.
In the gift of the Taoiseach. That's ridiculous.
Yes,
he shouldn't be able to give it out like sweeties.
No, exactly.
To people who've helped him.
It's not a ball.
I think the logic behind that is
that reduced its standing as well.
That it avoids the prospect of the two houses being differently composed, so that you don't have a government that has a majority in the Dáil being stymied in the Shannon. But yeah, I know. 087-1400-106. Let us know your thoughts on that. I didn't expect to spend so much time on the Shannon, so much time that we have to take a break. More when we're back with Valerie and Declan after. I didn't want to ask Shane while he was on the line. Declan, any interest in getting Botox as advertised in the Sunday Times today?
No. I can't quite understand it, because I think one of the differences between men and women is that men, as we advanced, we always had the easier ride in a way, getting grey, a few wrinkles, maybe even a bit of baldness, all added to the gravitas.
Very distinguished.
Well, it's the general idea. Well, certainly, it kind of, if you were in a certain type of role, you always... having a baby face wasn't an advantage at all if you were a man. So I can understand it from the female perspective. But obviously times have changed, and obviously the newer generation of men out there want to have the pulchritudinous visage that the ladies have as well. So more look to them.
I hope they come out with that vocabulary as well.
20% of men, apparently, in one clinic, 20% of their clients are men.
Right. And I assume it's the face, because I believe that people can get Botox in the posterior region as well.
In other places too.
You know more about this than the regular parts. But apparently one of the best clients are the fathers of the bride. They're all coming in for it.
All right.
And the ones look great when they're walking down the aisle.
To get their trout pouts sorted out.
Such is the stigma that might have been there previously removed, that one therapist who's speaking to the Sunday Times today says that for the male patient, in 5 years' time, you will look at your friends and they'll have either had the treatment, or be having the treatment. It seems like a boom market to get in, Valerie, if you've got the money to invest in that sort of thing.
To be honest, I think it's absolute rubbish. I don't know why men are doing this. In fact, I don't know why women are doing it either.
Yeah.
I mean, I put them both on equal footing. I mean, it's vanity. Yeah. And yes, fine, I suppose if people want to do it, that's grand.
Yeah.
But I think letting yourself age gracefully is probably a better option. The frightening thing is that this is happening to quite young men. Mm. Some of them are only in their 30s. So are you signing up, Gavin?
I'm a man in my 30s and I haven't done it. But never say never. I work in a very superficial industry and there's always a younger model coming up behind
you. You can have baby Botox, apparently, when you're still very young.
Okay, oh, is that what it's called? When yeah, okay, baby right. I'm not right. so far researched.
I think
that I
nothing
know that, much.
That, you know, reasonable diet, plenty of exercise, and a healthy approach to life. Anything for people that have had surgery for serious things, the idea of getting any kind of an intervention that's purely for cosmetic reasons must seem anathema.
You were very exercised. Speaking of things that are allowed usually age gracefully, usually people would think of wine aging gracefully. Valerie, you were very exercised by some news that people, I think, was it in the Business Post? I can't remember which one
that's
of the papers it is today.
To remember.
But that is one of the newspapers carries details of France having a wine surplus and taking some pretty evasive measures to try and get through it again.
Apparently it's all to do with Europe. We're not drinking enough wine.
And oh, we're not? Oh, gosh, so we have to be good citizens.
Yeah, we have to be good citizens.
Looking up now.
But I would have thought that during the pandemic, people went mad drinking wine, you know?
Yeah, wine and Botox, huh?
Yeah, and equal dose. Exactly. You could bring the wine home in bulk and nobody'd even know about it. But apparently not. People have not got back to it. And a lot of their wine sales, of course, would be through restaurants. And people have not got back yet to going out for meals and so on. So they've got this absolute wine lake in Europe. But the French, particularly in the Languedoc region, which would produce a lot of their wine, they've taken this very seriously. And the government is now paying them huge sums of money, millions, to dig up their vines. Now, I think this is a bit extreme. Dig up their vines.
Get out of the business.
Get out of the business and plant olive trees instead. And when you hear of vines that take maybe decades and decades to come to anything, and, you know, the strain is so important and the soil and all that, I can't believe the French government is doing this. I think it's something like 57 million they're investing in digging up their vines. And I really do think that we should advise the French and tell them, you know, this is not a good idea. What? 10 years' time, you're going to be really sorry. There won't be a drop of wine. But I think this is the idea. It'll come back as a very much more expensive wine.
Mail on Sunday is the one that has this story. French Agriculture Minister Marc Fesneau says that the fund they're putting together, the 200 million, is aimed at stopping prices collapsing so that winemakers can find sources of revenue again. So in actual fact, there's too many of them in the business.
Right.
And they're driving down the price, and that we all need to do our bit by keeping the price of wine up.
I'm just struck by it as we're talking about that diminishment. It seems to parallel another issue that has been written about in the papers today. I think actually it was the Sunday Independent, Liam Collins, a piece about the decline of the Irish pub. Or certainly, no, Liam's point is more the evolution or the changes that are coming in the Irish pub in terms of how we drink, the way we drink. And I mean, even just to the point that we're talking about wine, which would have been unusual in Ireland 20 plus years ago. You would wonder where it will all end. But I think in Ireland, perhaps we are recognising that we need to mind the pub, because it's not just about the consumption of alcohol, is it? It's about the consumption of community, the engagement with community.
Absolutely.
And I think maybe the parallel there for the French is that their consumption of wine has always been about discourse and about society. So they're very careful about how they tinker with it, because in France, it's very egalitarian. From the high to the low, however one decides that, they like their wine. So if you're turning it into a more expensive elite thing, I think you might have a bit of a backlash, and nobody does backlash better than the French.
Let that be the final word from Declan Power, defence and security expert, and from Valerie Cox, journalist and author. Thank you both for joining us. We're going to be talking about apprenticeships and whether there might be a solution for many people who could be disappointed by the CAO. That's coming up after the news. Don't go away.
On the Record with Gavin Riley, Sunday morning at 11.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation always disrupts, but it doesn't always need to be disruptive.
On News Talk.